Over the last few years, something terrible has been happening in China, in the northwest province of Xinjiang, 1,000 miles from Beijing. The government has constructed a network of internment camps and has been imprisoning ethnic minorities in huge numbers. Uyghur and Kazakh people are rounded up for expressing their religion, for speaking their languages. They're arrested on the merest suspicion of what China considers disloyalty. And that's a very broad umbrella. At least 1 million people have been sent to these camps. It's the largest detainment of civilians since the Holocaust in Europe. The State Department has deemed it a genocide. And finally, the world seems to be taking notice.
The International Olympic Committee is coming under criticism as human rights organizations call for a boycott of the Games because of China's human rights record, including the...
You just talked to China's president.
Yes, for 2 hours.
What about the Uyghurs? What about human rights abuses?
We must speak up for human rights. It's who we are.
We're devoting our entire episode today to Xinjiang, what's happened there and why, and what the world can do about it. I'm going to start with Rafi Khachaturian, a longtime staff writer at The New Yorker, who reported the story surviving the crackdown in Xinjiang.
There's been a long history of repression in this part of the country. In Mao's time, especially during the Cultural Revolution, the Chinese Communist Party attempted to solidify its control over the region by effectively diminishing the local culture and the institutions that support that culture.
What is the threat that Beijing and the Communist Party react to? Is it similar to, say, Tibet?
You know, that's a very interesting and complicated question because this is something that I wrestled with, because there is the threat and there's the perception of threat. But disunity, I would say, is a big concern. The Chinese government see these people or regard these people as insoluble to the body politic on some level and are pursuing a policy to change that.
You know, in the Soviet Union, which of course cracked up in 1991, partly because of nationalisms all over the Union, there was always a great fear in Moscow of ethnic groups and the so-called satellite republics. And it came to pass that Latvia, Lithuania, Armenia, Azerbaijan, the Central Asian states, all had their own nationalist movements. Do the Chinese look at the Soviet example as something that they desperately want to avoid?
Yeah, it definitely did elevate those fears and help motivate a series of policies that stamped down on ethnic feeling, on ethnic identity, by weakening the use of the local languages, which had been, during the 80s, permitted and allowed to flourish, taking the similar attitude toward religion. There's one quote, David, that stuck out in my mind, which is that the project of stability would be enhanced by developing man and standardizing man. And I think that's what we're seeing today.
Rafi, sketch out the map of things. How many people are being detained? How many people are in these camps? And what are they like?
Yeah, so there seems to be a startling amount of consistency in the accounts that we're getting of people who were put through the camp system. They are brought there. They are typically given instruction in the, quote, national language, which is Mandarin Chinese. Someone who's never spoken the language is now basically being told to speak only that language. And so they're consigned to silence in the camp until they learn a few basic words. That happens intensively. They are put into a program of political indoctrination where they are required to basically regurgitate party propaganda, the sayings of Xi Jinping, and frequently profess their loyalty to the party, to the state, to profess their gratitude to the party and to the state. So that's what happens in the camp. The scale of the camps themselves, the answer to that is a bit of a moving target, because what's happening on the ground in Xinjiang province appears to be evolving. As of about 2018, there were a number of estimates emerging that upwards of 1 million people were being interned in these re-education camps. That's about 10% of the minority population, the non-Han population in that province, which is a startling number. Now, that those estimates continue to rise after that time period, but at the moment, there seems to be a shift going on the ground. And I should tell you, David, information is very hard to obtain because the Chinese have made going to Xinjiang province so difficult. The Chinese government says that there are no people in the camps right now, that everyone is quote-unquote graduated. But there are a number of people who are currently incommunicado to their loved ones and to researchers who are trying to reach out to them. And reaching out to people is very difficult because of the all-pervasive surveillance. There definitely is evidence that a large fraction of people are being sentenced, and they are being moved out of these re-education facilities and put into prisons. And then there is a third category in which it seems that people are being moved out of the camps and into conditions of forced labor. So that makes it very hard right now to know exactly what's happening and exactly how many people are in this system.
And it's horrific. It's been reported that detentions in Xinjiang constitute the largest internment of an ethnic group since the years of the Holocaust, since the 40s. Why is this happening now?
That's an interesting question to try and wrestle with, and it was at the forefront of my mind while I was working on this piece. David, I think that it's useful to wind the clock back to the 2008 Olympics, because this was at a time when the Chinese authorities were obsessed with an idea that they called stability maintenance. As one academic pointed out at the time, the party was being haunted by a phantom of instability. And it seems that the Chinese Communist Party just identified this phantom of instability sort of under every rock in Xinjiang province. In 2009, there was a kind of catalytic event. Two Uyghurs in southern China were killed in a toy factory by a Han mob. And this, David, this just triggered some very large protests in Xinjiang that then became riots and then provoked a crackdown. They start demolishing historic buildings. They start restricting publication of websites and literature in the local languages, putting intense restrictions on faith and religion. And there comes a point where their paranoia about instability becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, because suddenly in 2013, we start seeing acts of political violence sort of emerging from Xinjiang province, where there had been none for easily more than a decade. None that could be clearly defined as acts of terrorism.
What happened that may have sparked the fury of Beijing?
Two of these events come to mind for me. One is a man from Xinjiang and two members of his family got into an SUV, and it was packed with incendiary devices, and they just plowed right into a group of tourists in Tiananmen Square. And there was another incident that occurred in Yunnan province, where a group of assailants wielding knives went in and attacked a bunch of tourists. There were some others as well. And in Beijing, these events only seem to validate the course that the party was already on. And so in 2014, Xi Jinping, who had just come to power, took a very radical turn by escalating these ideas into a people's war against terror that is really the starting point of what we see today.
One of the most amazing things that you describe is the surveillance program that Beijing has put in place in Xinjiang. It's extraordinary. Can you describe that?
It is all pervasive. It touches every aspect of life. I mean, there are countless personal accounts corroborated by people who have worked on these systems and built them, and software from these systems that have been obtained and studied by different groups, that show that if you walk out your door From the moment you do that, you are being tracked based on facial recognition. The information in your phone is continuously being logged. And as a result of that, not having a phone or not going out is also not an option, because those would be regarded as anomalous and cause for suspicion.
You know, if I live there, is it possible for me as a Muslim to practice my religion in any way?
You can't really do those things without risk to your personal safety.
One of the really disturbing details in your piece is that in 2018, birth rates in the region fell by a third. What happened?
Yeah, so that statistic was provided by the Chinese government with very little context. But academics and people who are studying this issue are trying to understand what is driving this precipitous demographic drop. One thing seems clear, and that's that the Chinese government is pursuing family planning policies in Xinjiang province with the ferociousness, with a kind of zero tolerance attitude that we're just not seeing in other parts of the country. What that means is, for instance, is that an infraction that might result in a fine in another part of China could send you to the camps in Xinjiang. It's also worth considering, of course, that if you divide and segment the population by gender into fortified camps, that too will, of course, have some effect on the birth rate eventually.
Rafi, of course, in the Holocaust, Jews were not only put in camps and work camps, but they were killed. They were shot. They were put in. They were gassed. We know the story. So anytime you raise the specter of the Holocaust and the specter of comparison, we should be detailed and precise here. Are Uyghurs being executed, killed in these camps?
No, that's not what we're seeing. And I'm glad you brought up that point. At the same time, Raphael Lemkin, who coined the term genocide in 1944, pointed out that the erasure of a people need not happen through the instruments of mass killings. And if you look at what's happening in Xinjiang province today, and you observe it to its ultimate endpoint, and if you imagine that the Chinese Communist Party has a long-term commitment to this policy, then it raises an interesting question about what a 21st century genocide might look like. Maybe the instruments of mass killing are not even necessary if you can confine physically a population for such a long period of time, if you can leverage the instruments of mass surveillance so comprehensively. At the end of the day, you may still end up with the erasure of a people.
Rafi Khachdourian, his story Surviving the Crackdown in Xinjiang, or Ghost Walls as it was titled in the print edition, is at newyorker.com.